Good evening. I'm K2 Kilowatt. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. I'm trying to act like K2 Kilo Echo Yankee Mel. And my name is Dick. Mel and Dick try to organize this this enthusiastic gathering of guys that's called the Technical Mess. Most questions get answered, not all of them. The group in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area gather and help each other understand this complicated hobby. The uniqueness about this particular net tonight is TechNet number 1,300 of the series that began in September of 1982. A person signs into the TechNet because he has a question or a comment for the net. By giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, try to remember that, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Tonight we probably will be discussing a little bit about how Channel 25 came back on the air, what happened at the flea market today, and anything else that people bring to the net that they think is worth discussing. Give me a call, letters, and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
November to X-ray Juliet, November.
Okay, Wesley, and a double. Who was the other person?
Yankee Hotel. Lou, yes.
Okay, Lou, quite a noisy signal. We heard something hotel. Give me the full call letters again, Lou.
Okay, now I can come in on the Eastern, which is loud, but it's delayed. So I got to jump in on the Western just to get your attention. November Yankee 2 Hotel, NY2H. Lou, yes.
Very fine, Lou. We got you very well that time. And that's too bad that there is that delay, and although I know you guys on the technical committee are working on that. So we've got Wesley and Lou. Anyone else like to sign into the Czech Technical Net? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
K2RIW, no. But I have answers.
Okay, we're going to be listening to your answers, Eric. Anyone else besides Eric to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2WGB, John, yes.
AC2AZ, Bob.
WS2N, Paul? No, but maybe later.
Okay, there was some doubling that time. I picked up John and Bob, and it was a third person. Who was the third person?
WS2N, Paul. No, right now, but maybe a question later.
I should have said Paul, but besides Paul, John, and Bob, there was another person that we missed that time. Give me your call letters and name again. Okay, Mel's going to tell us about the Hamfest, which he was at today, which I didn't get a chance to go to. There's another person trying to check in. Who was that other person? Okay, W2VB something or other. Freddy, I think you said your name is. Give me that a little bit slower, Freddy.
KB2VBN, Freddy Trump.
Okay, a very noisy signal, Freddy, but I think I heard KB2VBN, Victor Bravo November. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters at this time.
KC2YLQ, Peter, no questions at this point.
Okay, Peter with a no. Alrighty, first person who checked in was Wesley, a man who's assembling a significant laboratory in Queens. What's the latest with you, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2YDT, the name is Matt, checking in.
Okay, Matt, and do you want to be added to the list of people who have a question, Matt?
That's affirmative.
Okay, Matt with a yes. Wesley, go right ahead.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me switch off just a fast. Okay, I'm with you guys. Okay, how am I coming out?
You're coming out nice and loud and clear.
Okay. November to X-ray, Juliet, November. I was hunting for some additional equipment and for the project that I'm actually already started. And the proud to use based on Tesla coil. And I came across Korn Height, K-R-O-H-N, and it's dash, H-I-T-E. Well, then I was just thinking, how many problems do we have with RFI? How is DSP working? And how many problems do we have with the certain signals on the certain frequencies? And I came to the conclusion that actually printers are the devices that actually help us in this area. Let me drop. And there are three basic concepts of the filters. One is on based on Jay Bishop with very, very sharp characteristic. The other one is Bessel, B-E-S-S-E-L. And another one is Butterworth, B-U-T-T-E-R-W-O-R-T-H. And this company that I mentioned, Korn Height, actually, they have something that is expensive, but they also have very inexpensive filters. Low pass, bypass, any pass, actually any filters. And then they associate three filters at the same time. I wonder if DSP was actually using the same concept. And what might be the application for such devices, they operated from 170 hertz up to 25.6 megahertz. And if you can put any input in this area, I would appreciate. Oh, another thing is, the concept of the filter is only the coil and the capacitor. Only the coil and the capacitor. And all of the things that we do with the signal is just the coil and the capacitor. Isn't it amazing? Back to you, Dick, and to Adrian.
Hey, you're into a significant area of study, filters. Usually we design filters to be high pass, low pass, band pass, or band reject. In other words, a signal is flowing down a transmission line usually, and the signal may have come from an antenna, may have come from an oscillator, may have come from an amplifier, may have come from a mixer. In a lot of cases, there are certain frequencies you favor, and other frequencies you do not favor. You want to reject them. If, for instance, I was using a super heterodyne receiver, which usually consists of an RF amplifier into a mixer. The mixer has a local oscillator signal. It has the RF signal. And the difference between the two is called the IF signal. And then the next stage of amplification is the IF, intermediate frequency amplifier. And a good rule of thumb for a super heterodyne receiver is each stage of conversion is roughly a 10-to-1 ratio. If I was building a receiver for 144 megacycles, for instance, I might choose a first IF at 10% of that of 14 megacycles, and I might choose a second IF of 1.4 megacycles. These are very rough numbers, rough rules of thumb. But in order to do that mixing, you want to make sure that the signal coming in at 144 megacycles doesn't have the image and the reel. If your first IF frequency, let me change things a little bit. Let me make the first IF 10 megacycles, and I'm listening to 144. One way of doing that would be to have a local oscillator at 134. So a local oscillator at 134 megacycles, let me drop, mixes with your desired signal of 144 megacycles. The difference between the two is 10 megacycles. Your IF at 10 megacycles then does the next stage of amplification. In a typical receiver, there would be a band pass filter after the mixer, and the band pass filter would be intended to allow the 10 megacycles to flow through, reject the 144 and reject the 134. You're rejecting the LO, you're rejecting the RF, and you're passing the first IF of 10 megacycles, in my example. There may be another filter on the RF input amplifier, making sure that nothing but 144 comes through. In that example I just gave of a local oscillator at 134, and an RF of 144, and an IF of 10, it has that, what I just described, as a so-called real response. There is also an image response. Every signal that's 10 megacycles away from the local oscillator is capable of coming through that mixer and ending up in the IF strip. 144 is the one that I favor. 134 is my local oscillator. A extraneous signal of 124 is also 10 megs away. So therefore, if the RF input port of my mixer in question had a 124 megacycle signal and a 144 megacycle signal, both of those signals would come through with equal gain through that mixer. Both of those signals would end up as the 10 megacycle IF, and the signal coming out of the loudspeaker, you wouldn't know if it is a 144 megacycle signal or a 124 megacycle signal in my example. Therefore, you're going to probably put a filter in front of that mixer, allowing 144 to pass through, and hopefully that filter will have a
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And hopefully that filter will have a lot of rejection of 124. So I've got a RF amplifier filter favoring 144, rejecting 124. And how many decibels of rejection of 124 I can get out of a reasonable design of filter, and what's the shape of that filter, what's the insertion loss of the filter, what's the skirt selectivity. Now you're getting into a lot of details of filters. If you read some of the good books on filtering, there is a chapter that's quite significant with lots of charts and graphs and diagrams. In almost every single edition of the Reference Data for Radio Engineers, that's the name of a book, which I think is now in its 8th edition. I own about 6 of those editions. Each couple of years they come out with another edition. I think they keep changing the name a little bit. I believe it's now called Reference Data for Radio and Computer Engineers or something like that, or Radio and Communication Engineers. But that's an extremely good book. If you just start Googling the word filter, RF filter, bandpass filter, reject filter, and so on, you'll find lots and lots of filters. Let me drop. Once you decide what you want to pass and what you want to reject, and you have a shape that you can draw as a diagram on a page, as a graph where frequency is the horizontal axis and amplitude, usually displayed in decibels, is the vertical axis, and you can draw in there, if you wanted to, what they call an ideal filter, one that has vertical sides, a straight top with no insertion loss, and a vertical side on the left side and the right side, which begins the rejection passband or the rejection frequencies. That theoretical filter you and I would like to draw on a piece of paper is called a brick wall filter. Nobody can ever synthesize a brick wall filter, but you can come close. As you use a larger number of inductors and capacitors, each inductor-capacitor pair is quite often called a pole, or depending on your definition, it's called two poles, but you can make a two-pole, a five-pole, a 14-pole filter, depending on how many inductors and capacitors you put into the filter. That's if you're building it with discrete components of inductors and capacitors. Let me drop. And the design of the filter is a function of selecting the right inductor in nanohenries or millihenries, the right capacitor in picofarads or microfarads, the right ratio of their values, the right topography, the right coupling coefficients between the individual stages of the filter. As you get into the nitty-gritty of the filter design, there are many ways of making that filter. Butterworth is the starting position that many of us start off with. The nice thing about a Butterworth filter, I think that's named after a particular man, who did the filter design, is that it has a passband that's completely flat. There is no wiggles to the passband. You and I might design a filter for this particular handband, which passes 144 megacycles to 148 megacycles, and beyond 148 megacycles, it starts rejecting on the high end, and below 144, it starts rejecting on the low end. And now, you would like the insertion loss to be very small and very flat across the 144 to 148 megacycle region. A Butterworth filter can do that for you. Very flat passband. That's the good news. And also the roll-off of the skirts of the filter on the high side and the low side are a nice, smooth curve. However, the Butterworth filter has this nice, smooth-looking response. It has a group delay distortion that if you're passing a very wideband signal, like a television signal, you might not be happy with the fact that the signal in the middle of the band at 146 megacycles is passing through your filter in a different amount of time than the signals on the ends at 144 and 148. It has a differential group delay distortion. That's one of the disadvantages of a Butterworth filter. Another kind of filter you can use is called Chebyshev. Chebyshev is a Russian designer of a kind of filter that became popular, I think, in the 1930 time frame. He uses different coefficients for the inductors and capacitors with different coupling coefficients, slightly different mathematics than the Butterworth filter. The good news about the Chebyshev filter, let me drop, is that the skirt selectivity is much sharper. In other words, the rate of fall off, in my example, for frequencies higher than 148 and frequencies lower than 144, the places where you want to reject the signal, the Chebyshev filter rejects much more rapidly. The curve of the realizable filter has a much sharper rate of descent between the passband and the reject frequency. That's the good news. It has a slightly different kind of group delay distortion, which in many cases is more desirable. The bad news about the Chebyshev filter is that in the passband, it's not completely flat. It has some minor wiggles. You can choose a Chebyshev filter with a tenth of a dB of ripple, a half a dB ripple, 1 dB ripple, 2 dB ripple. At first you'd say, gee, why don't I choose a Chebyshev filter with 0 dB ripple? You do that, and the Chebyshev filter has become Butterworth. As you allow the amount of ripple in the passband to increase, the skirt selectivity increases. The sharpness of the filter in the reject frequency regions increases. So there's a trade-off. Depending on how many dollars you're willing to spend, depending on how many inductors and capacitors you're willing to put into the filter, depending on how much volume you've got to assign to the filter, let me drop. You have all of these trade-off factors, and how much ripple in the passband are you willing to tolerate. If you allow more ripple in the passband, you get a sharper filter in the reject region. But as you sweep a signal across the band, the fact that if it's a five-pole filter, you're going to have five wiggles to it, so to speak, in the passband, five peaks and valleys. If you've chosen a half decibel peak-to-valley design Chebyshev filter, and there's only half a dB of difference as you sweep across the band, that might be a very tolerable situation, and it may be a very good trade-off. All of life is a trade-off. And filters, there are people who have spent a good fraction of their career designing and building filters. When it comes to the most exotic filters, you would like the individual holes of the filter, the individual tuned circuits, which if you were doing it with ordinary discrete components, they would be inductors and capacitors. And depending on the quality of the inductor, how much resistance it has, the quality of the capacitor, how much series equivalent resistance it has, determine some of the characteristics of what is realizable with a filter. If you go to the highest possible tuning elements that you and I can buy. Let me drop. The highest possible tuning elements you and I can buy are well-designed quartz crystals. A quartz crystal resonator, the kind you use for determining very precisely the frequency of an oscillator. If you're smart enough, you can choose an array of crystals, put them together with the right coupling coefficients, with the right design of the crystals, their center frequencies and their Qs and whatever, to make what's called a crystal lattice filter. The nice thing about a crystal is that in a very small package, you can realize a quality factor of numbers like 50,000. Whereas with the best inductors and capacitors you can buy and put them together in a reasonable circuit, you might have a Q of 500, but you can get a Q of 50,000 and above if you use crystal lattice filters. So among the people who are very serious with crystal filters to get their very high performance are people who build crystal lattice filters. I believe Mel spent at least 6 months of his life choosing the right crystals, putting together the right way to make a crystal lattice filter. And I think it was a humbling experience. He got a lot of performance, but it took a lot of work. I'm going to pass it over to Mel to give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch as to what he went through to learn the mathematics, to learn the design procedures, to collect the right hardware, to build that filter. And although you can get very high performance out of those filters, whether or not you go out and spend a lot of money and have somebody build it for you, or whether you go through the learning curve of building it yourself, as Mel did, he'll tell you a little bit about what it was like. K2KEY, tell us what it was like, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, it is K2KEY, yes. In the process of building a very sophisticated receiver based on the Roche Schwartz design, I got involved, like you said, with the filters, and I understand that you want to pull your hair out of your head, as they say. This is a good place to start. The use of the filters, in fact, I'm back at it again because I started a project, but it'll be a winter project before it's finished. I'm building a spectrum analyzer / panoramic display for another receiver, and back into the filters. In fact, the crux of building a spectrum analyzer really lies in the work you do with the filters, because if you don't really pay attention and make that filter circuit, especially in a double conversion design of a spectrum analyzer, you wind up looking at your own stuff that you're really not interested in looking at, that you're generating, in fact, your own misery, as they would say. So the filter really is the crux of it. Now, the filters that I did, let me let it drop, and then I'll mention the filter that I did build. Okay, the filter that I did that Dick alluded to, that was really a project, they are very pricey. So I went ahead and I built myself an 8-hole filter. And of course, the difference basically as Dick was alluding to between Chebyshev, Butterworth, Gaussian, and other filter responses lies mostly in the component value. And a ladder filter, the design of a ladder filter, that's what I wound up. Crystal ladder filters are very fascinating. The problem is you've got to get the right crystal. So I wound up with 1,200 crystals, all 3.58 megahertz crystals that were used in TV VCR. I figured they're plentiful, very, very cheap to buy. The whole thing to buy, I actually buy 100 of them. It was for like $10 for 100. So it wasn't a great outlay considering what it was worth to buy a commercial version. But I had to build a crystal tester. And the crystal tester had to be able to tell me certain things about the crystals that was very, very important. Measuring especially the Q factor. And the Q factor is really, it all hinges, of course, on the frequency accuracy known as the loop frequency. See, you have to match all the stuff. You have to match it up with what you're dealing with, what they know as the series resonant frequency. The crystals actually become part of what's known as the loop frequency. So if you can't obtain your crystal, tune a crystal
series capacitor, and all that is part of known as getting the loop frequency correct. And there's quite a bit of mathematics involved with this and everything, a lot of experimenting. I think I'll let it go at this point. But especially worrying about the ring factor and what's known as the Gaussian linear phase response. I mean, there's a lot of different things that can be looked into. Now, there's a very good program that I did get called LADPAC, L-A-D-P-A-C, which has tables for Butterworth, Chebyshev field filters for lossless 6, 8, and 10 pole 0.5 degree equal ripple phase and Gaussian to approximately minus 6 dB for prototype building filters. That is a very good place to work with filters in the modern world today. Go ahead, Dick, before I get too deep into this. Over.
Yeah, for those who are tuning in late, you're listening to TechNet number 1300 of the series that began in 1982. This is the technical net given in New York City every Sunday night for the last 27 and a half years. And Wesley, one of our frequently signing in people, has asked the subject of filters. And there are filters and there are filters. My goodness, there's a lot of them. When it comes to RF, band pass, band reject, low pass, high pass filters, Chebyshev, Butterworth, elliptical, Bessel, and so on. You can choose filters that have a particular amount of ripple in the passband, a particular amount of rejection, a certain number of poles. As you add more and more poles to the filter, it has more and more capability. Poles mean you're adding more inductors and capacitors if you're doing it with discrete components, or you're adding more individual crystal resonators if you're doing it as a crystal lattice filter. There are filters that are called Lin phase and the equal group delay distortion and so on. The filter design procedure involves a lot of mathematics, a lot of understanding. Each individual company, let me drop, usually has a individual, like in the case of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, let's say the 1980 time frame period, when we're in the middle of designing the defensive receiver for the B-1 bomber airplane. During the time we're designing that receiver and we wanted very good filters, we had this little old guy named Henry Keene, W2CTK, a ham radio operator who cut his teeth building ham radio circuits and learning how to do filters. So if you needed one of these elaborate filters, you could either spend 6 months of your life learning the art and science of building and designing and constructing and debugging and getting into the manufacture of filter. You could do it that way, or you go over to Hank and say, hey, Hank, I've got a problem for you, Hank. I need a filter that does this, this, and this, and I don't want it to do that, that, and that, and I got this number of cubic inches, and I got this number of dollars to spend. Can you design me a filter? And 98% of the time, Hank would say, yes, give me a couple of days, and I'll give you a paper design where we can start building an engineering prototype. And he would go around and start using his mathematics of Bessel-Hankel functions and whatever, and he'd come up with the filter for you. And 98% of the time, you're extremely happy. There was an expert. As you can tell, filters are not simple. Yes, you can put a single inductor and a capacitor together. You can tap up on the coil of that filter with an input connector and an output connector, and you'll get a Gaussian-shaped passband, and you'll have the very first step of an extremely broadband, medium-low-performance filter, and then you can start adding more and more stages to it. So building filters with real hardware, inductors and capacitors and whatever, let's call that an analog filter. Very popular technique. You can buy it, you can build it, you can go to an expert, and know ahead of time that it is no simple subject.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a hell of a lot more to building and designing filters than first meets the eye. That's the bad news. Some good news is that when it comes to along with digital signal processing techniques, if you've got a high enough dynamic range, analog to digital converter, you take the input signal and you digitize it with an analog to digital converter, and now you've got a whole string of digits, of binary numbers, and you put them into the right kind of a computer program. That computer program, properly designed with the right kind of feedback procedures and whatever in the various stages of the computer program, can design for you any filter in the world. Chebyshev, Butterworth, elliptical, limb phase, whatever. And there's a zillion kinds of filters, constant K, M-derived. It can design for you that filter. And after the computer program has taken your signal, properly processed it, and then you take the output signal, which are binary numbers, and put that into a digital-to-analog converter to convert the signal back to the real world of a real sine wave analog signal, that process can work extremely well. The process can be an extremely small integrated circuit that in some cases, it can build for you in a few millimeters of dimensions. It can synthesize for you a filter that would fill up your whole desktop if you really built it in real hardware. It might be able to synthesize 50 individual inductor and capacitor pairs, or 50 individual crystals, and so on. You're about to say, all righty, if the digital signal processing, let me drop. If the digital signal processing can design for me a filter that is almost unrealizable in the real world, because I don't have enough money, I don't have enough cubic inches, I don't have enough dollars to buy all of those components to build that elaborate filter and debug it, and the digital signal processing filter can do all of that for me, band reject, band adaptive filtering, and so on. Why in the world isn't everybody using a digital signal processing filter? It pays you money, it takes your choice. It gives you a hell of a lot of performance for the dollar, for the cubic inch, and so on. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's got some other nasty characteristics. It's got residual responses of various kinds due to the actual digital to analog and analog to digital forming process. You put a signal in there that's too strong compared to what it was designed for. Your input analog to digital filter goes into a phenomenon called flat topping and bottoming, or wraparound. In other words, if you design the input filter to go between 0 and 1 volt, and if a spike of energy comes along at 1.5 volts, which is beyond the dynamic range of your analog to digital converter, which is the very first step of your digital signal processor, what's going to happen? In many cases, all hell's going to break loose. The digital signal processor, first stage, that analog to digital converter, when it sees a signal that overloads, it either gives out a single voltage of 1.0 volts, or it wraps around and gives a voltage of 0.5 volts. If, for instance, you gave it an input signal that's just a little bit above the design, it's designed for 1.0 volts, and you give it 1.05, it might wrap around and give you an output response of 0.05 instead of 1.05. And when you go through all the stages of that particular signal, and for instance, it was the front end of a radar that's doing digital signal processing, and I've worked on such a project, my goodness, you have grief downrange. Wow. It creates all kinds of phony signals.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Your misdesigned and misused digital signal processing program will display for you all kinds of phony signals on that radar screen that do not exist. And I lived on a program that had that problem, and it went on for years because of an improper design. So the bottom line of all this is, no matter what you choose, you gotta know your limitations. As Clint Eastwood said in some of his movies, a man's gotta know his limitations. Every piece of hardware you choose is going to have limitations. There's a tremendous amount of capability of a digital signal processor, but be wary. The advertising design for the digital signal filter that you're about to buy, on paper and in the design and at the website, it'll look like it's the best thing since warm bread that was ever invented by mankind. If you've got enough experience, or if you talk to somebody who's been down the road with the faults that digital signal processors can create, you're going to start asking a number of series of questions. What residual signals, what phony signals can it create? What happens when it's overloaded? What happens when it's underloaded? If the signal going into the digital signal processing filter is too small, it gives an improper response. If it's too large, it gives an improper response. Certain kinds of combinations of signals in band and outer band will give improper responses. Now, many of the top-of-the-line ham radio transceivers that you and I can buy these days have built into them some rather nice digital signal processing filter designs that do all kinds of fancy things, like if somebody comes on the 20-meter band with a key-down signal because he's lining up his transmitter and he's creating a continuous tone, there's a kind of filter that will take out that continuous tone and leave everything else that's left over. Beautiful techniques. So the DSP that has been evolving in the transceivers that we can now buy is getting better and better. It's getting higher and higher in performance. The amount of digital signal processing that exists in that cell phone that you use every day, you'd be amazed how much of that is in there and how good a job it's doing. But it has limitations, and there are times when it gives responses that are not easy to explain. So the word filter, I guess, I sometimes use this example, Wesley. If a person asks what he thinks is a simple-sounding question, and my crazy example is, should I marry a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? You think that's a simple question. There's a lot more variables involved. Which one of these filters should I use? Should it be done with discrete components, with inductors and capacitors? Should it be done with crystals? Should it be done with integrated circuits? There's pros and cons to all of those decisions. The majority of filters these days are being done with digital signal processing. But to design your own is a fairly elaborate process. To go out and buy somebody's well-respected design, in many cases, you get a lot for your money. If you feel overloaded when you start studying filters, you realize that you're climbing another mountain, that there are people who have spent a good fraction of a career studying, designing, improving, and using the various styles of filter. That gives you some idea of what's involved. It's not a simple subject. There are people who treat it super simply. Sometimes they get into trouble. Every filter, usually, even a filter built out of inductors and capacitors, it has
repeater, timeout, cancel.
This is the last thing I'm going to tell you about filters. You may have designed a beautiful filter with real lumped components, inductors and capacitors. And you designed it for the 144 to 148 megacycle passband, and you want to reject everything else. And within the frequency region of 0 to 200 megacycles, it may do a beautiful job of that. Many filters have a reentrance characteristic. If there's a strong enough signal at 550 megacycles, it may also come roaring through that filter, even though you didn't design it to do that. Every filter has other extraneous responses. If you've done a good enough job, all those other extraneous responses are 1/1000th or 1/10000th, in other words, they're 30 dB down or 40 dB down of the main response. But almost every filter, no matter whether you build it electronically with digital signal processing or you build it with real inductors and capacitors, there will be other undesired frequency responses, and you'd like to know about that before you go too far downrange. There's an awful lot to learn here. You've asked what hell of a subject, Wesley, and as you can tell, you can't, on this particular one, you're not going to learn brain surgery in 15 minutes, as they say. N2XJN, who asked one hell of a question, K2RIW, you got it, Wesley.
Can I say one more thing, Dick? K2KYW.
Go ahead, Mel. And what did you finally do with that crystal lattice filter? You got it, Mel.
You alluded on to something very interesting that taking you to the next step is the design today of what is known as microstrip filters. They have come up with a very good Macintosh program that's AIDS, and it will give you very interesting information on a part of the filter that is very important, known as the unloaded Q factor. And it's based on the fast Fourier transform, FFT. And it was designed by the Newton-Raphson, N-W-T-O-N. If you want to look it up, it's very interesting. If you're interested in filters, Newton-Raphson, R-A-P-H-S-O-N technique. I found that invaluable, and especially it is designed for to work with, if you were, I think we're saying, making these nice, compact, little microstrip filters that is used now mostly in all your modern equipment, especially into the cell phone industry. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, there are computer programs that will really help you design filters faster. I can't think of the name of the famous college now in southern New Jersey who has a series of programs that will do impedance matching and filter synthesis for you. And these particular programs have been made into a very user-friendly form. So going to the right computer program can give you many steps ahead on the learning curve. You tell it what characteristic you desire to have out of the filter, what center frequency, what passband, what ripple, what rejection, and so on. There are programs that will do a beautiful job for designing that filter. And by the way, the filter itself doesn't only have to be filtering. It can simultaneously be doing impedance matching. In theory, you can design a filter that has a 50-ohm input impedance and a 10-ohm output impedance. And therefore, it's doing simultaneous filtering as well as impedance matching into the next stage of your transistor. Not many people mention that. And there are also kinds of filters. One more thing I'm going to mention to you. One of the things that was in my magic bag of tricks as a quasi-filter designer, I'm not a good filter designer, but some of the crazy characteristics of filters I have studied, let me grab them, and that is the so-called constant impedance filter. 99% of all the filters in the world pass certain frequencies and reject other frequencies. That's the whole reason you use a filter in the first place. And how does it reject those other undesired frequencies? Does it eat up that energy and turn it into heat? Absolutely not. 99% of all the filters you know about are called reflective objects. In other words, at the frequencies of rejection, the input impedance of the filter becomes a 10 to 1, 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1 standing wave ratio. Of all the energy you're applying to the filter, that frequency, that energy that's coming in on the wrong filter gets thoroughly rejected by the filter, and it gets sent back to the source as a standing wave ratio. Well, in the case of using that kind of a bandpass filter on, say, for instance, the IF input amplifier of your superheterodyne receiver, all of that energy that you reject in that filter and you're sending it back to the IF port of the mixer, a mixer, you may think it's a passive component. It's a very peculiar kind of active component, and all energy that you reflect back into it, it's going to find some way of creating a frequency response that you didn't know about, that you didn't care about, and it's going to give you some grief. There's conservation of misery there. So there's a whole class of filters that are very rarely known called constant impedance filters. There's a way that's a little bit more difficult of designing a filter so that the input impedance of the filter looks like 50 ohms resistive DC to light, so to speak. Constant impedance filters. There's a whole series of design programs that can do that for you. And if you're smart enough to use one of those kinds of filters on your mixer input and mixer output ports, you'll get a lot more performance out of the mixer. Because when you read the data sheet on that mixer,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The manufacturer has put it into a test fixture which presented a 50 ohm resistance across all frequencies on all three ports of that mixer. And he measured the performance. And yes, he now knows in the pure sense what the mixer is capable of doing. Unfortunately, 98% of the time, that is not the real world. The real world is that you've got a local oscillator on that particular port which has a defined impedance only at one particular frequency, the local oscillator frequency. And the same thing for the RF and the IF port. Therefore, you get entirely different M by N, mic by November responses of the mixer, the 2x3 and the 3x4 response and so on. Those are integer numbers that represent the harmonics of the RF and the LO and the IF, and the mixer will give you all of those responses at different ratios depending on the impedance it sees on all of its ports. So as you can tell, Wesley, there's an awful lot to learn about mixers, about filters and mixers. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is November 2X3, Juliet, November. Oh, I knew that it's going to be a long discussion about it. Well, I would like you to take a pen and a paper because I have a few questions, a short one, but I believe to the people who do not really very much understand everything about the filters, it would be good to answer to give you answers. But first, before I go to the question, let me jump. You you covered Jay Bishop. Actually, Butterworth filter is a very interesting one, and it is designed to have frequency response as flat mathematically as possible in the passband. And actually, the name of that filter came from the Stephen Butterworth in 1930s. And he said this beautiful word, and I'm going to repeat this word. An ideal electrical filter should not only completely reject the unwanted frequencies, but should also have uniform sensitivity for the wanted frequencies. That is up. About the Bessel. Well, the Bessel actually has a... refers not really to... Actually, it refers to the type of filter response, not to the type of filter. And it features the flat group delay in the passband. The very few filters are designed with the square waves in mind. Most of the time, the signals filtered as sine waves or close enough that the effect of the harmonics can be ignored if a waveform with the high harmonic content is filtered, such as the square wave. The harmonics can be delayed with respect to the fundamental frequencies if Butterworth or Chebyshev response are used. Actually, I remember at the time when I was doing very much scientific work, we were using the filters and we were actually trying to treat them with the Fourier series to find out the details about it. And one thing that I memorized at that time, let me drop. The square wave is the infinite series of odd harmonics or sine waves summed together to create a square shape. Obviously, if a square wave is transmitted without distortion, all of the harmonics out to the infinity must be transmitted. That means that a square wave can be high-pass filtered without distortion. And if I recall it properly, that was, correct me if I'm wrong, the 3B point of the filter is significantly lower than the fundamental one. If the square wave is low pass filtered, but however the situation changes dramatically, we'll be trying to low pass filter the square wave. Okay, now the question. Okay. For the people who are not really very much in the theory of filters, the resonance. So I would like you to take the stand of the parallel resonant circuit. It's a filter. What frequencies passes? What frequencies does not? The series resonant circuit. What frequencies passes? What frequencies not? The third question, the amplifier of every ham radio track has the filter, the T-filter. How the T-filter works? Well, I know. But another question that I have is, if you have the programmable filter from 107 Hz to 20.46 megahertz, and you can have four channels, and you can set any frequency starting, any frequency ending, and you can actually do whatever you wanted. Pass it, stop it. What would you do with such device? I found it on the eBay. $20. The filters for $20 that you can maneuver with the filters whatever you want, and filters for $2,000. Where you can do the same. So it's up to the manufacturer, up to the chance, and I believe many people, let me jump, many people fighting with RFIs, or if you do it as a peak with the unwanted frequencies from radio stations. The frequencies from nearby station. Anything could be done with the filters. So, back to you, Dick, and I would appreciate your input in this matter. And to XJM.
Yeah, now we're getting into some of the more elaborate things of what a filter can do for you. There are kinds of RF amplifiers these days which are neither Class A, which means the current flows continuously into the amplifying device, or Class B, where the current flows through the amplifying device half the time, or Class C, where the current flows through the device for 70 degrees. Each of these has its advantages. Class A, more linear, but not very efficient, 50% maximum efficiency. Class B, a little bit higher efficiency. Class C, numbers like 70% efficiency are possible. Then there are new kinds of classes, which are called Class Delta and Echo and Foxtrot, where the amplifying device is now producing a kind of a square wave. And the amplifying device, therefore, is either in the full conducting mode with very little voltage and high current flowing across it, which means it's producing an output signal, but not dissipating any signal, because the voltage and current product at every instant of time across your amplifying device determines how much power it dissipates. And let me drop. If your amplifying device goes into the square wave mode, where it either goes into full conduction, lots of current, but no voltage, during that time it's dissipating no power, or half a cycle later, it has no current flowing through it, maximum voltage, but again, no power dissipation. But your amplifying device is now making something that looks like a square wave or a variation of a square wave. With the right kind of a filter connected to that amplifier, the voltage inverters that we use, for instance, that convert 12 volts into 120 volt sine wave AC, use some of these techniques, square wave inverter. With the right kind of a filter after that, it'll pass the signal you care about, which might be a 60-cycle sine wave, and reject everything else. So there are kinds of amplifiers which can run at numbers like 90 and 95% efficiency when running into these higher class modes. That's the good news. The bad news is that it requires a rather elaborate filter. That's one of the examples of where really elaborate filters are required. And yes, a square wave. A square wave at 60 cycles, for instance, a pure symmetric square wave at 60 cycles contains nothing but the fundamental plus only odd harmonics. Let me drop. A pure 60-cycle square wave would contain significant energy at 60 cycles, significant energy at 1,800 cycles. That's 3 times 60, the third harmonic. The fifth harmonic would be 300 cycles, and so on. Only odd harmonics are present in the Fourier series of a square wave. Mr. Fourier is a French mathematician who worked out the spectral study of various waveforms. If you've got a particular repetitive waveform at any all shape that you care about, and you do a Fourier analysis mathematical process on that waveform, it'll tell you how much energy is present in both the in-phase and quadrature, sine wave and cosine wave, at all of those individual frequencies. And if you took all of those individual odd harmonic frequencies of just the right phase and just the right amplitude and mixed them all together, even though every one of the signals you're mixing together is a pure sine wave, you do it correctly, you will be synthesizing a pure square wave. That's the forward and reverse process that's possible with square waves. But when it comes to really elaborate filtering, let me drop. The broadcast industry is really forced into some very elaborate filtering. A modern-day digital television transmitter has an extremely stiff requirement for adjacent channel power ratio. If you're on channel 21 frequency region, for channel 21 digital television. The FCC, I think, has a requirement of something like 80 decibels of rejection of all frequencies that are outside of that 6 megacycle region.
Five.
How many Davies? I'm going to pass it over to Eric. Eric, tell us, how elaborate is that filter? I'm guessing it has to have group delay distortion that's very well controlled, or else you're using some kind of pre-distortion to control that. And I think you're telling me that all adjacent frequencies must be something like 85 dB down, and I'll bet you that filter is lots of bucks, lots of cubic feet, a big voluminous object that's required for your FCC-approved transmitter. Give us a few words on that filter, because from one point of view, that's the state-of-the-art of high-power filtering. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW in the deck net.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. It's not as steep as you think it is. Actually, the mass requirements is 55 dB, but most people try and shoot for 65 dB. The final mass filter is really a cavity at the UHF frequencies, and it's a gigantic cavity at VHF frequencies. But there are other methods in which to do that. Some folks do it by creating notch filters at the end of the bandpass. But one of the things I wanted to point out is that you can think of a Fourier transform as a device that converts from the time domain to the frequency domain, and you can think of an inverse Fourier transform as a device which converts from the frequency domain back to the time domain. And there's a lot of good uses for that. But one of the things I was going to say as I was listening to Wesley, and you know, of course one of the things that being about the coverage, the fact that the square waves are, you can think of it as a sine wave, and all of its odd harmonics, let me get a drop. With today's FPGAs, and actually it depends upon how much resolution you want, which goes back to like the problems you were having doing digital filtering with digital processing with your radar. We have things like successive approximation register type of D to A's these days, which a few years back we had them, but the problem was, you know, having enough speed. Today with the FPGAs, you can actually do 32 and 48 bits wide, and I even can get you some FPGAs that will operate well into the 300 megahertz range, which means the sampling is at least twice that, but we can get stuff that will sample up to almost a gigahertz at this point. So the concept of digital filtering is getting one heck of a lot better, and actually in many of the digital transmitters today, the earlier ones, of course, they operated at an IF frequency of 45 megahertz, which is kind of standard from the analog transmission days, but we are now actually generating a lot of this stuff on carrier frequency. So if you're talking to UHF, you're talking in the 5 to 6 megahertz range, 600 megahertz range, so that technology is improving one heck of a lot. And let me go to drop again. The real filtering requirement is at the transmitter, whereas the receiver doesn't have to be as sharp, and because the edges of the filters are so sharp, you can actually have adjacent channels. You'll see that there's actually a channel 20, a channel 21, channel 22, sitting one right next to each other. In the analog world, we used to have a white space between them, because one picture carrier would bang into a sound carrier, and the sound carrier would bang into the next picture carrier. That's why cable systems, for so many years, and still have the problem. In the analog world, they actually have to drop their sound carrier. Instead of it being 10 dB down, they make it 20 dB down. So, you know, analog technology versus digital technology gets to be a bit of a contest, whereas even though we're talking about digital transmitters, it's still an analog filter. K2RIW, K2J.
Thank you for that information. While I've got you, Eric, a number of people were mentioning last week that we did not have proper operation of Channel 25 from Brooklyn, New York. And there's some nice TBS programming on Channel 25-1, and you get these beautiful live scenes of various streets in New York City on Channel 25-2. And quite a few of us were not getting proper reception of Channel 25 all of last week. and a few people were getting reception. It was quite a mystery there for a while. Each one of us would have